I'm Stephanie Overbuck.
I'm Mel Wymore.
And this is Pot of Gold.
We know what we need to do to make a difference on climate change. That's obvious. So why haven't we changed course? According to Jenny Stevens, director of the School of Public Policy and Urban Affairs at Northeastern University, it's not a matter of our technological capacity, but a matter of our social capacity to disrupt the status quo.
In this episode, we speak with Jenny about the importance of centering anti-racist and feminist leadership in the fight against the climate crisis. By aligning movements for social, economic, and ecological justice, we give ourselves the best chance of seeing the changes we need to make for the well-being of people and planet.
I'm Jenny Stevens. I'm a professor and director of the School of Public Policy and Urban Affairs here at Northeastern University in Boston. And I've been working on climate and energy issues for my whole career, so about the past 25 years or so. And originally with a science and engineering background, but what I've realized throughout my career is that it's the social and political dimensions that are most challenging. And that if we keep having a science and engineering technical fix lens, we actually are not going to be able to adequately respond to the climate crisis and all the associated social justice and climate justice issues that are related. So what I recently wrote a book called Diversifying Power: Why We Need Anti-Racist Feminist Leadership on Climate and Energy. And the main argument that I make here is that we have to center and acknowledge and reveal the problematic power dynamics of who is involved in thinking about these issues, who is coming up with approaches and solutions. And we need to be more inclusive, and we need to listen to and engage with diverse stakeholders of all kinds. And acknowledge the structural challenges that a lot of the ideas for how to address the climate crisis are actually perpetuating and reinforcing.
That's a really great place to be coming from. I mean, I share your experience as an engineer. You can often come up with some great innovations, but you know, if you don't have the team or the people behind that, it's not going to happen. And clearly, that's been the case with climate change. I thought maybe we could take a moment to just get the status of where you think we are with climate change before we dive into the kind of key point on the social side. Where are we, and what is your sense of you know, what's left to be done?
Yeah, so we are at a point where for decades, the science has been clear that the Earth's systems are being disrupted, primarily from the burning of fossil fuels. And we need to stop that, right? Like that is the biggest, it's not the only contributor, but that is by far the biggest contributor. So we're at a point where the science is clear, we know what needs to be done, but the problem is what some of us are now calling the polluter elite don't want us to stop relying on fossil fuels. And so there are all of these very strategic investments to sustain the status quo, to make us think that we have to have fossil fuels. There's no other alternative, but that's not the case. And so I think when we allow other voices and more inclusive perspectives, we realize that we have other options and we need more deeper transformative change. So my focus really now, and I encourage everyone to be thinking about transformative approaches. If we're talking about doing something, changing something that isn't transformative, then it's actually could be worse than not doing it because it can reinforce the status quo. So that's kind of where we are on climate. It's an exciting time. You know, it's also a frustrating time for those who've been working on this for decades. But it's also a time, and I think especially right now with in what we learned over the pandemic, that so even our responses to the pandemic have done the same thing. They have actually exacerbated inequities and vulnerabilities among us. And the steps that were taken to kind of stabilize things in a very unstable time All the benefits have gone to those who already have privilege and concentrating wealth and power. So if you look, there was just a report released last month that shows during the pandemic, the top 10 billionaires, who are all white men, have doubled their wealth since the pandemic started. So there's something wrong with that. Like, that shouldn't be happening, because, and everyone else's economic status, the 99% of the rest of us, have declined in our economic stability and situation. So that needs to be addressed. And until and unless we connect responding to the climate crisis and moving away from fossil fuel reliance with this problematic concentration of wealth and power that our systems and our structures and our policies seem to be just feeding right into and reinforcing, I think things are just going to keep getting worse. So that's where I invite everyone to really think about transformation. We're at a point in society where we need bigger systemic thinking. And it's not about individuals. It's not about whether you drive, this car or that car. Obviously, our individual choices make a difference. And we're all part of the systems that we're part of. But so many of us don't have that many choices. And that is actually a strategic initiative to constrain what's possible to keep things the same. So I think we need to move away from individual responsibility and really focus on these problematic power dynamics, the concentration of wealth and power that keeps getting worse and worse and worse, and disrupt some of those things so that we have space to really talk about what matters.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that's one of the premises of this show, is that economic imbalance and climate change are inextricably linked together, and we need to dive deeper at those causes, those root causes in economic terms and social terms, in order to get at the solutions of both inequity and climate change. They kind of hold hand, they're hand in hand. And I just, when you speak about transformative solutions, I wonder if you could give us an example of what you're talking about. Sometimes transformative comes across as woo-woo, or whatever, like we're not sure what it looks like. But what do you mean when you say transformative solutions?
Yeah, so, I think a very tangible way of thinking about transformative solutions is investing in people and communities that have been under-invested in, marginalized systemically, historically, for a long time. So we need to move our conversations, every conversation, I think, and every policy and practice and priority actually needs to be centered on social justice, economic justice at the core, because if we don't do that, what we do is continue to propose specific initiatives that may have some benefit toward climate mitigation, but doesn't actually change these power dynamics and the inequities, and it could even exacerbate, right? Like so many examples, like electric cars and Teslas, for example, it's like only very few people have access to that. And if we perpetuate that as like the solution to climate, it excludes people and it actually exacerbates the divide among us. So we need to be focusing on kind of social justice at the core, and every policy needs to be paying attention to investing in underinvested in people. And so it's really a people's first approach. And it's an approach, and obviously this can be implemented at multiple different scales. So locally and statewide, national level, international level. But we need to kind of take back the possibility of public investments. And, you know, our reliance on the private sector to kind of do good in the world isn't working. Case in point is the billionaires are not pushing for these changes that are absolutely essential to address climate, which, as you point out, is directly connected to the economic inequities that are getting worse. So until and unless, you know, we get that as the priority, I think we're kind of spinning our wheels a bit, right? In terms of very tangible specifics, I'm here in Boston, where we have a new mayor here in Boston, Michelle Wu, who is pushing a Green New Deal for the city of Boston, a Green New Deal agenda, which connects climate, energy, transportation, health, and jobs. And an example of what she's trying to do is make the public transit here in Boston free. You know, so change the assumptions of how we pay for public services, because it recognizes how mobility, you know, we talk about upward mobility and economic mobility, but how we actually get around and how people have access to getting around, it has direct implications for jobs and integration of neighborhoods. And Boston is a very segregated, divided city. And the idea of making the public transit free provides an example of how to connect climate justice issues with economic issues. So that's one very tangible example here in Boston.
I wonder if you think all of these solutions, you know, it seems like really what we're talking about is stop talking about climate, start talking about injustice, really. And then have, you know, kind of foment a movement around addressing inequities in all different levels, including around climate. And, you know, I don't think we would ever disagree with something like that. I think it's a really great idea. But one of the conundrums I think people grapple with is government versus private action, you know, like personal action versus government action, business action versus government action. And, you know, we're so polarized, it's almost impossible to get policy passed, you know, in this way. I wonder if you have specific thoughts about how do we solve this polarization? How do we make this not so much a political battle? And I know, you know, Stephanie will jump in here about this, but sometimes we can deal with equity issues, not necessarily from government, but for interesting new innovative community ways, like new currencies that are more inclusive, or new ways of having cooperatives that are more inclusive and build resilience within a community. So I'm wondering if there's a way you can speak to both the polarization issues and the how politics have also been co-opted by the elite, so to speak, and makes it very difficult for us to make these transformative movements. And are there unique ways we could bring people together around the call for equity?
So I think of those as those two kind of questions as intricately linked to each other. Part of the reason why we've become so polarized is, as you mentioned, kind of strategic investment over decades to kind of undermine our democracy and our respect for and understanding of the potential of government, I think. And then also at the same, simultaneously to that, a disconnect within our communities of sharing and cooperation and coordination and collective, the sense of collective. We've gotten so individualistic that even in our neighborhoods, you know, we don't rely on our neighbors the same way that we could or we should. And when you don't, you lose some of that connectivity and the relationships and the trust that comes with knowing your neighbors and asking for help when you need help. So I think, you know, these are linked together, both the And I think focusing on local community building, capacity building, collective action is something we can all have, is accessible to all of us in different ways. It might be awkward or uncomfortable, especially if we're living in isolated places where there aren't a lot of immediate obvious ways to engage in your local community. But there really are opportunities everywhere. And that's one of the things that I write about in my book, and kind of elevate some of these amazing diverse leaders who are just doing phenomenal work in this collective space. There's so much more going on at the grassroots local level than many of us know or understand or are aware of, because we have limited capacity to know what's happening locally. Obviously, with the internet, there's a lot of national and international communication, which is great. And, you know, we can also leverage local connections. But we, with the media, the way the media has kind of declined in terms of local coverage of what's going on in our own cities, towns, neighborhoods, we lose sight of the power of our collective action together. One other thing that I'll just mention in this same time here is I talk about, my book is about leadership and encouraging us all to think of ourselves as leaders. I don't talk about leadership in the way that, you know, we have CEOs of companies or even elected officials. Obviously, you know, we are all leaders in our communities and our families and the organizations that we're a part of, our faith-based organizations, or our educational, our schools, our different organizations. So, and we can all act as leaders. It's kind of an empowering way to think about our own agency. And again, I think we've been kind of encouraged not to think about our own agency and our collective action. And I think we really have an opportunity to resist this divisiveness and the polarization by getting back to basics.
Yeah, and I would like to add on that, because I think a lot, you said we are almost like programmed not to think about or not to connect, no? And that's so true. This is, I think, with what's going on in a lot of communities, especially in the ones which are considered poor. It's like the thought is like how to get out of it instead of how to improve the neighborhood, how to improve within. And we almost trained, and this is what I would like to add, is how not to think about how money could serve us in a different way apart from getting rich. And whether this is this money system or another one, I don't want to even come to more complex, but just where do I put my dollar and how and what is my relationship to that dollar? I think would that question would... Each of us can actually have that question, what does this money do to me? And not just what, you know, and how can I give it and improve everyone else instead of, oh, I'm just getting rich. And it's really like, and then I think a lot of people want to get rich and then they don't know what to do with that wealth once they have accumulated it, you know. And this is another thing I think you can see in our world, right, with all these one percenters kind of being completely disconnected to what's going on in the world, or let's just go to Mars, you know. I just sent them, go and get it. But
no, and you're so right. Like so many of the people we can see, just getting rich doesn't make people happy. So what is it that we need? And I think one of the things when you talk about money and the financial realities of the way our society has now worked, and this is where the feminist anti-racist perspective comes in. We know that, you know, if we measure everything with money, we know that men have a lot more money than women. That doesn't mean men are more valuable than women. We know that white people have a lot more money than non-white people. Yet we know that everyone has value. And the problem is we've associated everything with the money. So like, part of the transformational thinking is also to separate from this way of thinking of that everything has to do with dollars and cents. I mean, obviously there's a movement and there's such an important movement to redistribute wealth, right? So it isn't only the concentration of wealth isn't only among the white males, but we also need to place value on things that are not captured in the money system, right? And that's where care work, relationship building, there's so many intangibles that those are the things that make us happy, the reciprocal relationships that we have, the care and the interactions that we have with each other that bring us joy and love and you know, those are as we talk about, they're priceless, right? There's not something you can buy or but the problem is that so much focus on money has ended up, we're in a society that devalues all of those things that are so essential to human well-being. So again, this is part of the deconstructing these problematic power dynamics that are these structural, patriarchal, white supremacist systems that perpetuate, concentrate wealth and power among some while others are being excluded and wealth is being extracted from others. We also need to place value in these other aspects of what it means to be a human being. And I know that sounds very kind of theoretical, but as you know, there are lots of practical ways that we can engage with that, right? And that's the praxis of cooperatives and sharing economy, right? Using reciprocal kind of what and needs-based approach. What do people need, right? If there are people in your community not getting what they need, are there ways that we can make sure people have what they need, right? And it doesn't have to be through money. It can be through what people actually need in terms of materials and food and a place to live and those kinds of things.
And yet, you know, it seems like somehow we are almost stabbing back, because I think, and I don't know actually what it is, that we are so polarized, you know, that it's almost like choosing a football team. You're either left or right, or blue and red, in this case here in the United States. And maybe it's so much easier to just follow a simple message than going, having a moment and questioning yourself, what is wealth? And this is what we talked about now, right? What does it actually mean to me? What to actually do this work for yourself, what does it mean? Yeah. And I think if every human, and this is for me transformational work, if every human would actually ask that question, what is wealth for me? How am I rich? I think everyone, I'm giving now the answer.
Go ahead, Stephanie. Tell us what is wealth.
I think it's connection to people. I think this is really what makes us rich.
Yeah.
Others may say, no, it's the beachfront villa. Okay. And then I encourage to like think again. Maybe go and see and how that beachfront villa is, like just on your own for a week. It's pretty boring, I guess. But anyways, you know,
After a while. I don't mind it for a few weeks. Actually.
No, but you want to know what I mean. It's like, is it wealth? Is it real estate? Is it the beachfront villa? Is it how many apartments I can accumulate? I think a lot of people think that way, but it takes a bit of work to come around and say, hey, actually, what is it? What is it? What it makes me happy? What is wealth? And then you can go into the different levels of community and build from there. Anyways, this is what I wanted to add.
What I was going to ask is, in some ways, community work is also a privilege. And I think that a lot of people who would love to do community work or connect in their church or do the, you know, cooperative or all of that stuff takes time. And I believe that these systems have eaten away so much of, especially people with lesser means, their time. So sometimes it's not even a choice. You know, you have to work that second job in order to pay that rent or make that utility bill. And while you would love to join the community group, right, or reach out to your neighbors and start a cooperative to clean up your block or whatever it is, you know, I've done a lot of this community work, and it is often the people who have the time, which is also a privilege, that can put in that work. And so there's got to be a way for us to open up, you know, opportunities for people to engage that don't cost economic, you know, that's one question I have, is like, how do we do that kind of shift of focus and value and still have people thrive economically? And then I have another question, which is, so much of what the elite has figured out, okay, let's call it the elite, it's, you know, the corporatocracy or whatever, is that convenience is almost like a drug for us. So shifting someone from, you know, from Amazon Prime back to going to the grocery market with your burlap bag or whatever it is, so that you're making that shift, is actually really difficult. It's because there is an addictive quality to that convenience that the market is now offering.
Is this your own experience?
Of course it's my own experience. But those two things, those two questions, like, you know, we are talking about shifting our minds and also shifting our behaviors to a more communal, a more social kind of sense of satisfaction from those things. But how do we create the on-ramp to those? Like, how do we break these habits? How do we create an on-ramp so we can not only afford it, but we can, you know, take satisfaction and let go of some of the convenience that we have?
Again, I would connect those two points about time and convenience, because they're interrelated. And I think there's been literally, you know, decades of strategic investment to minimize worker rights and worker protections so that people don't have time, right? So people are very limited in their capacity to engage in their communities, in democracy. It's very limited, right? Because people are so precarious, as you mentioned, have to work several jobs and, you know, basically just focus on survival of themselves and their families, right? So that is part of this quite intentional reality that has been and continues to be perpetuated by the corporatocracy, right? They don't want people to have free time to engage and get involved politically, because then we might have more transformative, revolutionary action, right? And that's where we saw, like with Black Lives Matter protest in the summer during the pandemic, people were home and actually had more time, and the time allowed more people to get out in the streets, right? And we saw that. And so I think there's a connection there. And with the convenience piece, again, it's quite strategic. If we can stay home and click on everything and get everything delivered to our homes, never have to go out to a communal market, we stay in isolation as well, right? So I think bringing back the benefits of, and I think we've learned some of this also from the pandemic, you know, those of us who've come back into the office or come back to in-person shopping, if we did, you realize, oh, I can bump into people that I know and actually have a chit-chat conversation that I'm not going to have in a scheduled Zoom meeting. That's actually really valuable to me. We can resist some of the corporate strategy to get us to stay disconnected, right? And support local organizations in our neighborhoods, right? Small businesses, trying to give as much as we can of our buying power to people we know and support, right? Like, rather than putting it out into the universe and feeding into the corporate elites. So again, it might seem idealistic and not very practical for many people, because the convenience and the way these systems have evolved, we're all reliant on the quick fix and the easy approach. But we also do get to decide for ourselves, you know, in whatever ways we each can, where we are in the system, how we want to connect and engage. So, yes, it's a privilege to be able to have the time to connect and engage, and at the same time, it's a necessity, right, for a lot of folks.
You know, there's been a book, The Limits of Growth, and I think it was end of the 70s, wasn't it? And it was another kind of white man's club, sorry to say that, but it's a kind of Club of Rome, bunch of academics. Yeah, it's true, right? But we can edit and cut.
Excluding you, know? Jenny, don't worry.
No, but it's true. It's kind of an elite club, which at least they warned that there is the limits of growth, but they haven't made yet the connection to the money system, that this is connected to, and you have this wonderful line of elite of polluters, yeah? And the elite of money is basically the elite of polluters, and how the systemically was built up. And basically nothing has changed, really. Right. I mean, this book was a warning, and it was one of the first books I read as a teenager. And when you can see it from this time, it's really frustrating. It really is. But then I do think there is a key in there that we are going to get that shift, and that transformation is key. And I actually would love to just focus on this topic for an episode, yep. to be honest, because I do think it's key. Anyways, it's been lovely. I think we like steered the pod, and a lot of things came up. Yeah. A lot of smell and taste, and it's very good to hear about your book, and I hope a lot of listeners will dive in and read this.
And I think we've come up with one rubric for people in terms of how they could think about things, and that is, if you have a choice between X and Y, pick the one that gives you more personal connectivity. Whatever that is that you're doing, I think that's a way to go through life. Is like, you know, the one that gives you more community or the more connection, do it. Not necessarily internet connection, but because that's the alternative, right? Everyone's doing social media. That's their substitute connection. But we're talking about real connection here.
Well, the other thing I would just say is the other rubric is to think about deeper transformative structural changes. And obviously that's hard. Nobody knows like how to make big transformative changes. There's no formula, there's no recipe, right? Like, but we can, you know, if you have a choice between X or Y, I think focusing on prioritizing the thing that you think will actually disrupt the status quo problematic power structures that you're aware of, then do the other one when you can, right? Like, I think there's an element of disruption that is essential here, that we have to be, and you know, human beings aren't good with disruption. We'd like things to be stable. And that's part of our problem with our financial system. Like the central banks actually want to keep things stable because stability is the most important thing. Yet we actually need instability. Because if we keep things stable, we're going to actually, it's going to be unstable because it's, you know, not just limits to growth, but there's limits. We're coming up against all these limits that are going to, we're going to meet them. And there's going to be inevitably more disruptions of all kinds. Our systems that are set up to maintain stability are going to be completely ineffective. And we've seen that already with, the pandemic, but then also different disruptions with the climate already. And we really have an opportunity to shift that by having kind of a needs-based kind of approach of what do people need and how can we invest in people and communities in better ways.
The thing I thought was very interesting with Jenny is the term polluter elite. Who is the polluter elite?
I think it's corporations. I think we're talking about, it's really fascinating if you dig into what we're talking about, because the polluter elite is really about corporate policy to like waste or extract or do things in the name of profitability. But the corporation indemnifies the individuals making those decisions from being responsible for those decisions. And so it really comes down to kind of the underlying formula for profit making that needs to change, just like the underlying systems of economics needs to change, because there really is no single person that's responsible. It's what we've created together, and now we have to fix it together.
Right. And I think the much more effective and more powerful way would actually, if corporations would turn around and actually become not
the good people.
Yeah, the good, not the elite polluters, but the elite good doers.
Yeah, I agree 100%. That's absolutely true. And I think in order to do that, people have to be thinking about changing those business models, right? What if, for example, business, the primary goal of any business would be to sustain itself for millennia, like rather than immediate profit. What if the goal of a business was to simply stay alive and as a thriving entity for generations? Like, for example, the way, I know that you know about this, you're kind of an expert in the way builders would build churches, you know, back in the 2,000 years ago, build churches, even though they would die before that was complete.
Right? Oh, you mean the Middle Ages? That's not 1,000 years ago, but Middle Ages, early Middle Ages. Okay. So 1100, 20,
30. Okay,
yeah.
1,000. So that's 1,200 years ago, right? 1,000 years ago.
Okay.
Anyway. Okay. Not so good at time. But anyway. but the business model was to create something that would last well into the future, even though you don't see the immediate payback. You just are sustaining yourself as you do that. And what if that's what today's businesses did? What if we actually had business models that were like consciously designed to sustain that company and
not just the company,
all the people around it and all the resources around it forever, right? You know, like that would change tremendously.
To sustain the infrastructure, the environment is the primary goal and not the maximum profit. Sort of a long-term thinking, and that, for us, I think this is so hard to imagine. It's also hard to imagine that another example in the Middle Ages is that people actually had time. They had more time for themselves than we have today, or the average workforce
has today,
right? And also in terms of food. So there was actually an abundance. When you compare it to today, it's almost hard to imagine that we always consider us as being like the top, the cream of the cream, you know, of society.
Yeah, but really we're
and then you think back, oh my God, you know, they had more time off. And what it does, I think, when you have that time off, and I think we've seen it in the pandemic, where a lot of people were forced to stay at home and to reconsider what they actually want to do with their time. Mm-hmm. And how you want to work and where you want to work and for who you want to work for and what did you with all this leisure time. It maybe was a bit enforced on a lot of people, but in the end of the day, I think there is a bit of a, awakening to what is maybe more important to your life. And it also brings a connection. And I think that connection to nature and to the things which are important to us, and that basically as relationship and family and your friends and your pets and, you know, stuff you love, when you don't have time, you basically never the time to think about these things.
You're focused on your job or your profitability or your contribution, right, to the profitability. But getting back to the issues of climate change and some of the core messages of Jenny Stevens, it feels like what she's arguing for is a way more inclusive movement that combines these, you know, the holistic or the totality of the human experience. And that means including issues of ethnicity and race and economic fairness and climate change, to look at this as a whole, and not just, oh, we have race over here and climate change over there and income disparity over here. And I think we agree 100%. Like, that's why we started this podcast, right? Is to look at these underlying systemic integrations and disintegrations and how they impact people and planet, you know, and the huge amounts of disparity we have and the huge amounts of damage we're doing to the planet. And so I love that she's an academic that's bringing forth the need to bring these issues together and see them as a whole.
We are an independent, listener-supported podcast.
For the price of one latte per month, you can help fuel our work and keep our content untainted by commercial interests.
For more exclusive content, join us on patreon.com or click donate on potofgold.world.
Thanks to our producer, Riley Paul. I'm Mel Wymore.
And I'm Stephanie Overbeck.
Thanks for listening.